We'd like to take a moment to talk about Jane, one of our sponsors who helped make this episode possible. Jane is a practice management software built for every kind of mental health practitioner and is thoughtfully designed with your clients in mind. Jane makes it convenient to meet with individuals, couples, or families, whether that's online, via Jane's telehealth options, or in person.
From day one, you can expect unlimited customer support through onboarding that sets you up for success and a 99.99% software reliability that ensures that Jane is always ready to start the day with you.
Just as you are always learning and improving, Jane is too. The team at Jane values customer feedback and uses it to design even more helpful features. So you can think of Jane as a software that grows with you.
If you're curious to see Jane in action, head to jane.app/mentalhealth/US to book a free one-on-one demo. You can also mention the code DCPOD at sign up for a 2-month free grace period on your new Jane account.
I'm really excited and slightly anxious to announce that my book, The Autistic Burnout Workbook, is releasing this next week. It comes out March 11th. It's available for pre-order right now. I am trying to avoid falling back into burnout. When you release a book, there is a lot of pressure to do promotion and to market and to get the word out there. So this is my burnout prevention form of marketing. I'm running a special right now for those who are supporting my work through pre-ordering. You can submit that information after you pre-order, and we will get you a coupon code that you can use toward our store for the same amount. So the workbook costs $18.99. So then you'd get $18.99 to use in our digital shop or in our Etsy shop, which would get you another digital workbook for free. So you buy one workbook and then you get a digital one for free. That is the promotion I'm running. It's technically a pre-order promotion, but I've been a bit behind on getting the word out. So for listeners of the podcast, I'm going to extend that. If you buy the book in the next month, you can go ahead and redeem the special. The link for that is in the notes below. Thank you so much for supporting my work. It means so much to me, and I just really appreciate you and hope that you will find this a helpful resource for you as you continue to build a life that is a bit more resilient to autistic burnout.
Hey, everyone. You are listening to the Divergent Conversations podcast. We are two neurodivergent mental health professionals in a neurotypical world. I'm Patrick Cassell.
And I'm Dr. Neff.
And during these episodes, we do talk about sensitive subjects, mental health, and there are some conversations that can certainly feel a bit overwhelming. So we do just want to use that disclosure and disclaimer before jumping in. And thanks for listening. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Divergent Conversations. Today is going to be an interesting episode because I'm doing it solo without Meg and Anna, just for time zone purposes. And I have Adam Laylor. Did I say that right?
You did.
I should have asked. Okay. PhD is an educational psychologist and the vice president for neurodiversity research and innovation at Landmark College, who was one of our sponsors on Divergent Conversations recently for about 12 episodes. His research focuses on the college success and transition of neurodivergent and disabled college students. Dr. Laylor is a co-author of the book, From Disability to Diversity, College Success for Students with Learning Disabilities, ADHD, and Autism, and the co-editor of the forthcoming book, The New Accessibility in Higher Education, Disrupting the System for an Inclusive Future, scheduled to be released this summer by Oxford University Press. He serves in leadership capacities within the Association on Higher Education and Disability, College Autism Network, Learning Disabilities Association of America, and the National Center for Learning Disabilities. So, welcome to the show. That was a mouthful.
Indeed it was, Patrick. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, man, of course. So tell me a little bit, you know, for the audience's sake, like who you are and what you're doing, because it sounds like you're very involved in the higher education system and really advocating for neurodiversity affirming education and support. And I know as an autistic ADHDer, like going through college was pretty hellacious for me and for a lot of people listening. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, where this passion comes from? Maybe the why behind all of the things I just listed?
Absolutely. So, I mean, honestly, I am a neurodivergent and a person disabled by society, as are my children, my spouse, my sister, my grandfather. So it's something that certainly runs in my family.
Sure.
And it's something that runs in many families.
Yep.
It's not surprising in some ways that I gravitated toward in a field that really relates to me and the people I love.
Sure.
That said, my father was a special educator for his entire career, 40 plus years. And I grew up in those environments too. I mean, working with as a peer mentor for students with disabilities, and it's something that I absolutely loved. I did my undergraduate work in psychology, and then I did my master's in higher education administration, and then rounded it out at the only program in the country that has doctoral focus on higher education and disability, and that's the University of Connecticut.
Okay.
So I've been here now for, in this tenure, I've been here for just about 8 years, but I had a prior tenure at the college a couple decades back for about 3 years, and knew this is the place that I wanted to be. For folks that aren't familiar with Landmark College, we're the first college in the world solely for students with learning disabilities, ADHD, autism, and executive function challenges. Yeah. So, we're a somewhat unique institution. I like to say to folks that, we are to neurodivergent students what HBCUs, historically Black colleges and universities, are to Black and African American students, what women's colleges are to students who identify as women. We're a cultural community in addition to being a post-secondary institution of education.
So unique, when we heard. So to give some context for the listeners, we have someone who works on our behalf, Megan Ann and I, who helps us secure sponsorships for the podcast so we can keep doing the podcast for listeners. And he was like, hey, Landmark College wants to sponsor some episodes. And I said, what the hell is that? And so, Megan Anna does a lot more research than I do. I'm always just like, I don't know. Does it sound okay? And she's like, yeah, I think it sounds good. And, it's a college specifically for neurodivergent learners and disabled students. And I said, wow, that sounds really unique. You guys are in, is it Vermont? Is that correct?
Yep. We're at a small town called Putney, Vermont, which is, okay. Meant to give folks a visual on a map. We're right where New Hampshire, Vermont, and Massachusetts meet. So right in that little section there.
It's a very Vermont thing when I think about if there was going to be a college in the United States that really supported neurodivergent students, I would think of a couple of locations, but Vermont would definitely be on my mind. I went to college in upstate New York, Burlington, and spent a lot of time in Vermont. It's one of my favorite states. And, just the progressive nature and the more left-leaning thought process probably supports this quite a bit. So tell me about for our listeners that are all predominantly neurodivergent or certainly have loved ones or friends who are neurodivergent. Tell us about this college, the experience here, because for me, SUNY Plattsburgh definitely didn't do it right.
A lot of colleges are really learning in this area, and it's, many of them have come a long way in a very short time, but there's still a long way for them to go.
Right.
Landmark is a little bit different in that we, have been doing this work for 40 years now.
Right.
We're in our 40th year, and this has been our population since day one. If you think back in time to 1985, that's pre the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's pre, at least in terms of name, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. Those are still 5 years away.
Right.
So, I mean, with that, I mean, you found that, so many students weren't being served by higher education effectively because of their neurodivergence. I mean, that time we didn't even use the term neurodivergent, but essentially the profiles that would be part of that.
Absolutely. Hell, I wasn't even born yet. So I've been doing it for a while.
Yeah, I was a little guy. So it's a, it really was, we were founded by some of the real, earliest disability rights activists. Many of them had done work in other areas, related to race and gender. But, they were really the ones who said, this is wrong, that so many capable, intelligent students are not moving on to higher education when they can offer so much if provided additional education.
Yeah. And, it's about, how do we build in accommodations and knowledge and understanding and support, right? Because if we look at education through the traditional model and trajectory, it's like, it's kind of a one size fits all approach. And we don't have a lot of wiggle room for people who don't maybe learn in certain ways or have different processing styles or need different support structures in place to be successful. And that's a shame because that's an enormous gap where people fall through those cracks and they just get completely overlooked, dismissed, or missed.
Absolutely. I mean, and when we think about, how education is delivered within the post-secondary context, most of our faculty are not taught to teach, let alone teach for diverse individuals who have different learning needs.
Sure.
And need to be assessed in different types of ways. They're content experts. I mean, they might be wonderful biologists and they can tell you everything about biology. But we have to remember when they were in school, biology was their area. That's what they were passionate about. They understood everything that was explained to them in that course. And as a result, teach like they were taught. It's one of those things where at Landmark, our faculty and staff really are certainly discipline experts, but are really primarily teachers and educators. They have developed the skill to be able to work with incredibly diverse populations, and not just one at a time, but in groups, which frankly, blows a lot of minds of my colleagues at other institutions who struggle simply to provide accommodations to one or two students.
Sure. Yeah, that makes an enormous difference, right? When you're thinking about a potential safe, affirming landing space. Can you go into that a little bit? When you talk about the instructors and the teachers and just how curriculum is laid out and what this process looks like, because I think a lot of people listening may hear this college says it's neurodiversity affirming. What does that actually mean to Landmark? What does that look like on a day-to-day basis in terms of the student experience?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. In terms of being, neurodiversity affirming, first start by looking at the group as a cultural group. We try to celebrate who our students are. We talk about their history because, many of them have never heard about the history in our people.
Sure.
That stuff gets ignored in the history books. You might learn a little bit about disability in the form of the Americans with Disabilities Act and the Capitol Crawl.
Right.
Very, very infrequently do you learn about neurodivergence.
No, in my master's program for clinical mental health counseling, I said this before, I think the only time we talked about autism or ADHD was in a child development course for maybe 2 hours. We talked about potential disabling conditions and never even named it as neurodivergence, It was definitely not framed in a neurodiversity-affirming way or lens. And it was almost looked at from like a deficit model of like, these kids are really going to struggle. But we never even talked about the fact that these kids turn into adults, like, and what it's like to support autistic or ADHD adults. It was wild to me. It blows my mind.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of what is done in education is focusing on deficit, focusing on fixing and remediating, quote unquote, issues.
Yeah.
Now, I have to say that I'm not against remediation. I mean, I think remediation, when we think about it just being improvement in areas that we struggle in, I think is a great thing. I think everyone should be doing that.
Sure.
And I stink at math. It had nothing to to do with my neurodivergence, but certainly I can get better at it.
Sure.
And we all can. But to do that in the face of not exploring, recognizing, and growing strength really harms students, whether they're K-12, higher education. If we just drill and kill on vocabulary and spelling with never talking with the student about all the things they do well. And if they're an artist, helping them develop as artists, or mathematicians, if they love math, we don't do that. Often what we're doing is harming self-esteem, self-concept. Yeah. And unfortunately, a lot of students who are neurodivergent go to college with some degree of trauma.
Absolutely.
Something that is clinical in nature, like post-traumatic stress, or just in what I call little T trauma, that you've been impacted by discrimination and bullying, all of those things. It can be defeating. It can lead you down a lane that is not productive for you, and certainly not productive for folks around you in society. So part of what we do oftentimes here at Landmark is to, at its core, help students regain a love of learning that maybe they lost over time because they have been told all the things they can't do. One of the first things that we do when the students get here is we have a course called Perspectives in Learning. And we will look at documentation, but we look at we'll discuss areas of challenge, but we'll also show that students same documentation shows so many of their strengths.
Right.
All the things that they can harness in their lives and put towards use. We talk about the laws that protect our rights, our civil rights. We talk about things like identity. We're trying to teach students that despite what their prior education may have said, despite what society says, they're not broken. They're whole people.
Right. Sure.
They have hopes, dreams, abilities, skills, creativity, just like any other individual in our world. And then we provide opportunities for them to pursue those interests and dreams in an empathetic environment that is going to support them through various services and supports, while also letting them know that we believe in you. You can do it. That sounds super simple. And to some extent, I don't know why that doesn't happen in other places, it oftentimes doesn't.
Right.
So, as a result, we'll use methods to teach our students that really are more inclusive. A lot of educators will say, okay, I have a class of 20, so I'll focus on teaching to the average student in the class. And by doing so, you miss everyone that's not the average. But if you start using things like universal design, that you're focusing on the margins, I mean, who are the strongest students, who are the students who are struggling the most, and you teach towards them, you'll get the range of learners.
Yeah, I love that. Sounds like a very, you know, an inclusive, intentional space and thought process. So I have a couple of thoughts and questions that have come up. Yeah. Like, what does it look to be like sensory friendly and accommodating in a college setting? And what is it like when you have people with different like sensory processing different processing styles of information as well? So what's that look like in terms of a collegiate, like post-secondary education setting?
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what it looks like in most settings is not what it looks like here.
Sure.
A traditional campus, there's very little that's typically done. There might be things like sensory spaces on campus, low sensory rooms,
right,
quiet rooms, which, don't get me wrong, are excellent. I mean, that is, for many institutions, that is a big change and a great start.
Right.
But
certainly better than nothing.
Indeed. So, I mean, right, any movement in towards access is good movement.
Sure.
That said, there are other issues that sometimes go unconsidered. One that more institutions are becoming aware of is just the lighting. Lighting in certain spaces that can be sensory overload for some students. And using those fluorescent lights that we all complain about.
Yep.
It is something that can be changed at institutions, whether through filters or changing the actual type of bulb being used, moving to LEDs, is one way. Is it going to be perfect for everyone? No. But is it going to meet the needs of a greater number of students?
Sure. Yes. Absolutely.
Likewise, there are oftentimes accommodations that are used by students or provided that will allow them to individually adjust sensory environments.
Sure.
For example, wearing headphones in a class having access to different fidgets during an exam where everything has to be away. You got it. Here at Landmark, it's really a lot of that is just baked in to what we do. And I don't like that term baked in, but it's sort of the most clear term. Our students just get to do it. They don't
foundational.
Yeah, they don't need to request an accommodation to have, fidgets or to wear noise dampening headphones or things of that nature. There are challenges in certain environments. One being a weight room. It's hard to, given the nature of the environment, it can be difficult.
Sure.
But we'll talk with students about that. If that's something that is disruptive to you and painful, what may be a way to reduce that? Well, go at times potentially that are less crowded.
Right.
One of the activities that you really wanted to do is dumbbell curls, you might want to consider having a dumbbell in your room so you can control it.
Right.
So others are far more difficult. I would say like smells in a dining hall.
Yeah, totally.
Those are very difficult to control.
Totally.
So sometimes there might be options to be in smaller areas within a dining hall. We have different types of spaces that will allow students to identify one that may meet their needs a little bit better.
Sure.
We have a quiet room within our dining hall, so that folks can, if they need low, less noise, they can go in there. So, I mean, a variety of different things. I mean, we have, yeah. It's very common here to see students walking around with headphones.
Totally. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's just like you said, like kind of foundational. And then you don't even have to think about it as terms of like, can I do this or not? Is there going to be a reaction? Am I going to get in trouble? I remember, you know, and I'm curious about this, but like, what about movement in spaces? Like for me, it's hard to sit still. Mm-hmm. And I was very disruptive in class. Like that was always the thing in my report card, straight A's, but disruptive to all the students. And it was just like, I can't sit still. I need to be pacing. I need to be moving. So that was always a challenge. And then classroom sizes too. You know, I remember in college being in lecture halls of 500 people and just like, it was very challenging to be in those spaces.
Absolutely. It's, and I'm going to use the example that you gave of needing to move around. That's one that happens all the time. It's actually a focus of some research that our students did here on campus about, some students need to move around.
Yeah.
And then other students get really distracted about it. So how do you balance that? Oftentimes that gets looked at in a binary way. You either have to sit down or you can't be here.
Sure.
You're disruptive. And folks tend to not look at, what are the solutions that exist in between?
Sure.
One of the things that will happen if a student needs to get up and move around, that's common.
Yeah.
If they need to fidget and bounce up and down in their chair, that's okay. I am a prolific foot wiggler. So I'm business up top.
Yep.
And then, like, I look like a jazz dancer or a tap dancer below.
I can relate. Yep.
What are the options that I have? I could stay in that seat, or I could put a tablecloth over the desk, and no one sees what's going on underneath, so I don't distract anyone. Or if you have a student who needs to walk around, that can be really disruptive for a lot of students. I think about a student with ADHD who needs to move, and a student who gets disrupted or distracted by folks moving.
Sure.
So, the option is, move. Just move towards the back of the room.
Yeah.
And you're not in someone's line of vision. You're not going to be distracted.
Right.
So, there are solutions, but we as educators sometimes are not willing. We're educators are very creative.
Absolutely. I like that perspective of saying, like, we understand that there are going to be challenges here, but how do we figure out a way where this isn't black and white?
Absolutely.
I think that's unbelievably important. So I like to hear that quite a bit. And I'm sure the people listening are excited to hear that too. That's a bummer for me, because again, like, I think so many people have had these post-secondary collegiate experiences where it's like, I think a lot of people who are undiagnosed, especially, have such a hard time in these environments of figuring out like how to make this work, right? Like without understanding what accommodations do I even need in order to be successful. And I think it's hard for those who do know early on in their lives that they're autistic, ADHD, that they have some sort of disability or disabling condition. It's hard for them to go into these environments thinking like, all of my life I've had to do X, Y, and Z, and now I'm in this new environment. And am I going to be supported? Am I going to be accommodated? Like, are people going to, look at me differently? And I think it's important, like, to go straight into an environment where it's like, this is the expectation. This is how this is the culture that's created. And it allows for there to be a lot less shame and stigma, I think.
Absolutely. We have a unique population I recognize that, but there are elements of this that can certainly transfer to any institution.
Sure.
One of the things that you were talking about is that transition.
Yeah.
It becomes a challenge at some institutions, in part because of the legal changes.
Yeah.
Between students who are covered under IDEA and ADA at the, I mean, K-12 and then really ADA and 504 in higher education. We don't have the expectation or the mandate by law that K-12 does under IDEA that, I mean, really is in search of success.
Right.
Here in higher education, I mean, the focus is on access, ensuring that, and while some institutions will go beyond access, like Landmark and as well as some traditional institution, there are a lot that are really just looking to meet, frankly, the minimal compliance required by law.
Sure.
And I mean, even to go further, I think there, I mean, higher education as a whole is still clawing and scratching to hit that minimal compliance overall.
Sure. 100%. And we know that there are massive sweeping changes coming from this current administration in terms of disability rights and education rights and everything else. So it's going to be an interesting development in how colleges and higher education respond as well.
Absolutely. There's going to be a lot of questions still have to be answered. What's going to happen with the Office of Civil Rights? How is that going to impact compliance related to access?
Yeah,
and we don't know yet, and I'm not at a point where I'm ready to make assumptions about what's happening. I think it's fair for us all to be concerned about changes because we know that's going to happen, and
Absolutely.
What the implications might be for our students.
100%. A couple more questions that I have that I think listeners will want to hear. So class sizes, what does that look like? Do we have neurodivergent teachers and professors on staff? And what is training like to make sure that it's accessible and affirming? Because there's a lot of places that are I just want to check the box. I want to say the statement, right? I own a group therapy practice. It's very easy to say we're anti-racist, neurodivergent, celebratory, LGBTQ affirming. But if we don't do the work and we don't do the training, it's just a performative statement, right? So
absolutely.
Can you speak to any of that stuff?
Yeah. I mean, in terms of, being walking the walk, if you will.
Yeah.
If anyone came to you and said that they do it perfectly, I'd immediately call them liars.
For sure.
Being perfect in terms of access and equity and inclusion, it's not a reality because it keeps changing.
Yep.
Institutions have to be mindful and continually looking to improve.
Yep.
We do have a lot of opportunities to learn as members of this community, but we also do a lot related to going outside of our community to other colleges and universities, secondary school, corporate entities. I spend a lot of time over the years with the federal government, doing work really trying to support greater awareness and competency in terms of neuroinclusivity. So here we have trainings. We have an annual summer institute for educators where our faculty and staff and folks from around the world will come to our campus for 3 days of learning. But I was just getting some numbers earlier today from my certificate program coordinator, Carol Beninati, who oversees our online certificate program and learning differences in neurodiversity. And she was telling us that, our faculty over the last few years have taken more than 88 different classes with us just to continue their learning. They're optional.
Sure.
We do reviews of research as a community. We evaluate different strategies that are going on within the classroom and outside of the classroom to share ideas. I mean, it's important to know that the literature, the research on this population within higher education is thin. You said before, I mean, so much focus is on K-12, and you're right.
And before.
I mean, those early years, when you look at adulthood in higher education, it's very thin. It's increasing, but very thin. So you have to do a little bit of both. You have to look at the research, but you also have to look, observe and see what seems to be working and what doesn't seem to be working. I mean, hear and listen to the students. What's working for you and what's not? And then be willing to adapt what you do. I mean, frankly, I think one of the biggest skills, in addition to empathy, that our faculty have is their ability to be flexible and pivot based on the needs of the students, not just across the year, but in the moment.
Absolutely.
I can't remember what the third one was.
I was just asking about classroom sizes, but you answered the questions very well, so I appreciate that response.
Yeah, I mean, classroom sizes, I can tell you, we have a max classroom size of 16, but that's very rare that we get up to 16.
Can I tell you how horrific it is to sit in a lecture hall of 500 to 1,000 people with fluorescent lighting, expected to just sit there for 3 hours?
Yep.
And I remember one of those classes, because I was in upstate New York, was called Intro to Canada. And it was the most boring, no offense to any Canadian listeners, fucking class I've ever been in my life. And the ability to sit there for 3 hours with 500 people in fluorescent lighting, unable to move, felt like torture.
And I'll tell you, they're nearly impossible for the instructor as well. The sad part is when you're teaching those, you know that you're not reaching everyone. And you feel awful in that respect.
100%.
I would say most of our classes are about 7 or 8, but we have classes that might have only 2. They will fluctuate in that group. Obviously, like most institutions, your introductory classes tend to be a little bit bigger.
For sure.
But certainly, a very popular one is Intro to Psychology at every institution. That one may get up to 14, 12, something in that area. But that's beyond that, it can be pretty rare.
Wow. That sounds incredible. Yep. I ever need to go back for another education or a degree. Maybe that's the answer. So really cool, man. Like very, very unique, very fascinating to me. I imagine for a lot of our listeners also thinking the same thing. I'm assuming for anyone listening, if you're like, oh, wow, I think this is for me. One question that will come up is probably the tuition piece. So is there financial aid opportunities, scholarship opportunities? What does that look like?
Boatloads of financial aid and scholarships. All our students will have something.
Sure.
Our admissions and financial aid office work very hard with our students to ensure that they have options and they have access to different types of funding. Our admission process and our financial process is a lot more. It's having worked in admission, it's very different. We are a smaller institution, so we are really getting to have much more individualized relationships with students and can talk with their families, because oftentimes it's also their families that are taking out loans and things like that. So we can help them access things that may not be available at other institutions. For example, being that we are an institution that solely serves individuals that qualify as being disabled through vocational rehabilitation, there are funds that can be accessed, not by all students across the world, but by landmark students. wow. to support their education. So we'll that's stuff that generally doesn't get talked about by college counselors and all that, but we can help them understand the nuances and guide them through things like that.
Amazing. Yeah, that sounds like a very individualized approach as well. So really, really cool. You guys are doing some great work. And, you know, I know Meg and Anna would like to also probably extend a thank you to you guys because you did sponsor like 12 of our episodes over the last couple of months. So appreciate that. Always appreciate the support. And you guys are doing something that's so unique and so valuable. And again, having, you know, this fear that probably comes with the transition from secondary to post-secondary for so many of us, of the unknown and the uncertainty, to have a landing spot that feels affirming and supportive sounds really wonderful. So well done on that.
Thank you, man. What I say to the folks is, man, if anyone's ever in the area and they want to stop and visit and just feel accepted for who they are and I mean, what their brain does, stop by Landmark College. We'd love to have you here and show you around.
Sounds fantastic. Thank you so much, Adam, for coming on and making the time. For those who are listening, where can they find Landmark College? And we'll add this in the show notes too, so everyone has access to all the information.
Yeah, can certainly come check out our website. It's landmark.edu. There you can find information about admissions at our our high school dual enrollment level, and associates, baccalaureate, post-baccalaureate levels, as well as other resources that might be helpful for families as they navigate the experience of having children, young adults who are neurodivergent.
Very, very cool. We'll have that in the show notes so everyone has easy access to that. Adam, thank you so much for coming on and making the time today.
Thank you, Patrick. I mean, it's been wonderful being able to sponsor the show, and we definitely look forward to working with you going forward.
Perfect. So much. So anyone listening to Divergent Conversations, episodes are out on Fridays on all major platforms and YouTube. You can like, download, subscribe, and share. We'll see you next week.